Thanks for taking a walk with me and checking out the retail gems down the street, around the corner, and in our own backyards. In the Store Next Door podcast, where each show we talk to owners, managers, and employees of some of the coolest bookstores around and some of your favorite and soon-to-be favorite authors. I'm Doug Cooper, author of the award-winning novels Outside In and The Investment Club and the 2019 thriller Focus Lost. This podcast is brought to you by Rare Bird Books, based in Los Angeles, a publisher of 50-plus books per year, distributed worldwide by PGW. Today, I'm here with Rachel Swearingen, author of How to Walk on Water, winner of the 2018 New American Press Fiction Prize. Her stories and essays have appeared in Vice, The Missouri Review, Kenyon Review, Off Assignment, Agni, American Short Fiction, and elsewhere. She's also the recipient of the 2015 Missouri Review Jeffrey E. Smith Editor's Prize in Fiction, a 2012 Rona Jaffe Foundation Writers Award, and the 2011 Mississippi Review Prize in Fiction. In 2019, she was named one of the 30 writers to watch by the Guild Literary Complex. She holds a BA from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and a PhD from Western Michigan University, and now teaches at the School of the Art Institute in Chicago. Welcome, Rachel. Thanks for joining us on the Store Next Door podcast.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so debut novel, scary but exciting times. How's it launching a book in a pandemic?
I think it hasn't been too bad, surprisingly. There's so many people have been so kind, and doing this podcast with you, there's been other opportunities like that, and so it's been okay so far.
And I've talked to a few other authors that, I've said, it is terrible. We can't do events. But at the same point, some of them have said, it's kind of good. I can't do as many events because some of the book events, they're all always very stressful. You never know how many people are going to be there, who's going to be there. And they do take a lot of time, from the prep, the travel to get there, to do all that. And it's all time that we'd probably rather be reading, writing, doing other things, but it's necessary. And if anything, I guess maybe we'll get more of an appreciation for that, but just being creative, I think, with a lot more of virtual events, and so it's going pretty well, though.
Yeah, and I don't have a lot to compare it to since this is my first book, but I also think, I'm trying to keep everything in perspective. It's like you said, it's a debut book, and it's small press, and there's a pandemic, and there's a lot of really, there's much bigger issues and problems out there. So I'm just kind of trying to take it day by day and enjoying it. And I've gotten to meet so many cool people, and I'm reading some great books that I wouldn't have discovered otherwise, and going to some really cool events. And so, I think all things considered, it's going all right.
Well, it seems like you have some pretty good supporters already. I wanted to just read a few of the endorsements, the one from the New York Times Book Review, the stories in Swearingen's disconcerting and promising debut now explore themes of violence, chance, and the consolations of imagination. Publishers Weekly said the 9 stories in Swearingen's auspicious debut showcase a gift for well-paced, revealing details. Each of the intriguing entries builds suspense before a gratifying or lingering payoff. This crafty collection is worth a look. So some nice things said. And I think that one on Publishers Weekly was really echoed a lot of what, what I felt, the just richness and the density of your writing is just so, comforting. And it's also intriguing. Like, you can really unpack some of the sentences and details and really pulls you in.
Well, thank you for that.
Yeah. And, so when you started out, did you plan to write this book when you were thinking of, writing these short stories? Did you always know that it was going to be a book of short stories, or did they just evolve?
I did know that I was writing a book of short stories, and part of that was from being in grad school. I went into grad school with actually a couple novels I had started, and the format didn't work well for that. And I love short stories, and I've been writing them for a long time. But the book that I had in mind was not the book that I ended up writing, which I think is true for so many people. And so originally I was thinking of a collection of stories all centered on visual art in some way, playing with it, not always directly. And that definitely got into the book, but you know, there was you know, threads of like crime and detective stories that got into it. And, you know, the stories were much darker, I think, and more intense. I ended up really culling a lot of the stories I had down so that they were in conversation with each other. And so in the end, the book, the stories that I stayed with for this collection, they're really talking to each other in some pretty intense ways, I think. But yeah.
So there's 9 stories, and did you lay them out in a particular order? So would you recommend to readers that they read them, you know, 1 through 9, or is it okay to jump around and move around, or what's your recommendation?
This is such a great question, and I'm so curious. What did you do?
I jumped around.
Of course, yeah. So I think that and I tend to do the same thing in story collections. I start out reading them in order, and then I will jump ahead and I'll go back. And so I think that, you know, story collections are just the way that they're made. They open the door to that. And so I definitely went in with an idea of having kind of bookends, and I was, you know, trying to be very purposeful in how I organized them. But I also knew that that probably wasn't the way that most people were going to read it.
Yeah. And I, like I said, I read, you know, the first one, Felina, which I'm going to talk about here in a second. But then I said, oh, you know what? I want to jump to the end and then back to the middle and work myself around. And I thought it was really good to, you know, would read one almost like watching an episode of a television series, you know, would sit down and read one and then kind of chew on it for a day. And like I said, I just found the details and the depth to the writing, you know, just kind of hung with me throughout the day.
Oh, that's great to hear.
And, you know, just on that with kind of the television episodes, and it's kind of the golden age of television with all the series and popularity of binge watching. You know, if you had to pick one of the stories, which one do you think you would choose to develop into a series or something on film?
Well, it's funny. I've been thinking about different adaptations for this. I think most authors probably do this, but one story in here, which I actually don't think it's my strongest story in the book in terms of writing, but I think in terms of a plot that could work really well for a limited series, it's the Edith Under the Streetlight. And partly it's because I have a whole, I have an idea of where this story goes from where it ends here. And the characters, I think, could be, it's, you know, very contained in an apartment building with several different kinds of characters. And so that one, I think, could work well. And there's others that I think about, you know, making into short films or animations. Actually, the ones that I was thinking of animations didn't make it into the book. But it's fun to think about those things and then wish that you had, you know, 4 other lifetimes so that you could write them all.
Yeah, for sure. And when I was reading it, and one of the things I enjoyed was because, and I think one of the endorsements that I read touched on this as well, is that you really would bring stories to a conclusion, but at the same point, they could keep going. And, you know, how did you decide, like, where to end the different stories? Did you always kind of, when you're writing a short story, do you kind of have the end in mind? You know, what's your process?
So I'll tell you what I would love, and that is to always know the ending so I could write to it. I never know the ending. And when I think I have an ending, it's always a false ending. And I usually have to push my stories far past the ending that I end up staying with. And I think part of that's because I noticed this in student writers as well, that I have, I want to get out of a story when it starts to get uncomfortable. I want to, you know, to have a neat little bow tied ending. And those are such unsatisfying stories for me to read. And so, the endings are tricky and there's so many different ways to do it. And I think it's interesting too, like when I started putting these stories together in a book, I started seeing where I was doing similar things in different endings, and that made me know that I needed to up my game and, you know, find more strategies for how to end a story. And I think that this is why short story writers never get bored, because they're always trying to learn how to do things a little differently.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, that point you're talking about with the short story, you kind of envision the reader of, you know, are they getting to a point where they're looking ahead? How many pages are left in this? You know, are they starting to kind of lose the momentum with it? And you want to bring it to a close before that point, right? So how much editing do you do with, you had said you really worked and took a lot out. Over how much time were these stories in this book developed?
Let me see. I think it's about 10 years. And some of these stories took many years to write. And I think some of that's because I was still learning how to work. I now tend to write a story and I set it aside as long as possible. And then I come back to it and I don't have to revise as much. But when I was writing these stories, I was revising a lot. A few of them came out pretty easily. Like I caught the voice and I knew it, I let it take me where it needed to go. But, you know, the others just took forever. It's, you know, lots and lots of revision. I wouldn't even be able to really count drafts, because I tend to, you know, keep revising little by little. And so there aren't many beginning and end points for draft revision for me.
Yeah, I think that's, I know, you know, that was about the same experience I had with my first book. I think it was about a 10-year process from, you know, writing that first draft. And, you know, there's just this series of kind of milestones that you go through. And, you know, one of the great challenges I think of writing is, you know, people will always ask you, well, when do you know that it's done? You know, and especially the first time through, you don't know. Now I pretty much know when it's done. I mean, I've been through it three times. I'm in the middle of my fourth, and, you know, I've kind of got my process where I know when it's done. And the problem with the first one, I thought it was done many times, but you know, you realize, oh, I think like the first draft was, you know, 250,000 words, you know, and it's like everything you ever thought of, you wanted to put in there. And then that's just part of the process that you go through. What's your, so for the editing, do you have a trusted editor that, you know, after you've kind of gone through and you said, you know, I'm pretty happy with this, or I'm tired of looking at it, I want another set of eyes. Do you have a trusted first source or a writing group, or how do you proceed?
Yeah, it's been different for different stories. My husband tends to read the very early drafts, and he's not a writer. And so he gives me, you know, really good feedback as a reader. You know, if something's boring, he'll just tell me right out, this is, I don't know what's going on here. And so, but I don't share my work with people very much anymore. And I realize that my trusted reader tends to be the editors in magazines, because I'm, you know, with this book, and I would do things differently if I was doing my first story collection now. I think that my stories are so compact because I was constantly trying to make the stories condensed and short enough that a magazine would take them. And I was constantly waiting to get each story published before I would even think about putting it into the collection. And that makes things take so much longer. And, you know, it's hard to publish magazine pieces because there's so many writers doing this, and there's, you know, there's such backlogs for editors of work. And so there's, you know, benefits of doing it that way, because there's fantastic editors out there that will, you know, tell you when something's not ready. But on the other hand, I think it can hold you back in terms of finishing a book.
And are you a morning writer, a late night writer? What time of day is your high energy creative time?
I'm more of a morning writer now. For years, I was a night writer, and that was partly because I was, you know, working so much, and I had to kind of figure out what time, you know, between jobs, how to get the writing time in. But now I get up in the morning and write first thing.
Okay, I want to propose a little scenario here, just for listeners to get to know you a little bit. And you mentioned your husband. So let's say you and your husband have plans to go out on a Saturday night with another couple. You're dressed and ready to go, but before you leave, they contact you and have to cancel. What do you guys do? Do you still go out and make a night of it, or do you stay in and cozy up?
That's a great question. And one that you probably shouldn't ask someone after they've been married for, you know, 15 years. But I think it depends on the night. You know, if we're all dressed up, we're probably still going to go out because it's pretty rare that we do that. But otherwise, you know, may very well just, you know, whoop for joy and, you know, open the bottle of wine and stay home, which I think now after this pandemic and being trapped in the same house together, this is not going to be the same answer. When we come out of it.
Yeah, there's a point where you get where you, before you might be upset at people canceling. Now you're, like you said, it's a woohoo moment sometimes. Okay, so let's dive into the stories here. And like I said, the first one is the first one in the book. It's called Felina, and it's about this kind of mismatched pair that find each other, Felina and Arthur. So give us a little overview of this one. Set this one up for us.
So Felina is an installation artist, or at least that's what she calls herself. I think she calls herself a visualist. And Arthur meets her in a nightclub one night. She's wearing a hat and has an attaché case full of fabrics and is stacking cocktail glasses. And he's really intrigued by her. He's an investment guy, works downtown. He's kind of stuck and bored at the moment in his life and his work. And I think there's probably some stifled creativity in Arthur. And he's questioning the value of everything and just economics in general. And so they start dating, and Felina starts setting up her apartment in really crazy ways. And she's inspired by some Bourgeois installations that I've admired for a long time. And so my impetus for writing this book, or writing that story, was to have these installations and to really ask the question, if you put these art installations in someone's apartment, is it still art? And that question got me thinking about just economics in general and how we value things and what the work that we do, and when is creative work valued? When is it, you know, questioned? The same thing for the kind of work that we do in offices. And Arthur is increasingly horrified by these things that she's making in her apartment, and she's completely oblivious. She's, you know, really a pure artist in a lot of ways, and doesn't really understand economics of anything, doesn't really care that much. They're kind of archetypes in some ways, and it goes from there.
So what do you think? Very different people, right? And you know, I think there is that part, you know, about commerce, and Arthur does seem to be sleepwalking, kind of thing. And almost I get the sense that there's a little bit of a kind of a Ponzi scheme that he's you know, struggling with work. So what do you think the attraction is between the two?
I don't know. I mean, that's a good question. I think that there's chemistry there, and I think for Arthur, it's, you know, in so many of my stories, and actually it's painful sometimes for me to see this, but there's often characters that are triggering each other towards some kind of growth. And it's not always positive growth, but, you know, there's, you know, the catalyst and the protagonist. And in this story, there's a little bit of both going on, but I think Arthur has less of an effect on Felina than Felina has on Arthur. And Arthur's really an audience in a way. For her. And, you know, I guess maybe he is, but I thought of him. When I was working with this, I was thinking about the way this story is often told in stories by men, especially the ones that I grew up with. You know, like Arthur Miller has a really interesting one where a writer in a story writes on this model. And so I wanted to kind of invert that and think of Arthur as a male muse for the work that she's doing. And then it just got a little complicated from there.
Yeah, because he approaches it like he like you would expect him to, right? Very transactional. He's going into it for pretty base needs, base things. And he's intrigued, but he almost doesn't want to let himself, and he wants to deny himself. And there's a really great mystical quality to it. I mean, for a while, I was like, oh, does she exist? Is she a ghost? Is this, you know, there is kind of this mystical overtone to it that I really, that really kind of pulled me in.
Yeah, I had someone tell me that they thought she was a ghost, and I thought that was so interesting. I wanted to go back and read it with that in mind, because I definitely didn't intend that, but I could see, I think when I was, that this was the first story that I wrote in the collection. And I was, at that time, I was still playing with speculative fiction a lot. And so I was writing stories where the line between fiction, or between reality and imagination, was much thinner than in the later stories, where it's still, I think that question's still in a lot of the later stories, but it's not as strong.
And, you know, I think one reoccurring characteristic that people will see that I wanted to touch on is your naming of characters is so brilliant. Felina, Arthur, just great names. But as we go through, and we'll talk about these others, like in the next one, the only thing missing is the howling of the wolves, and, you know, Lynette, and which that really describes her. And in so many other stories, that just the character names, I'd be like, that's a perfect name for that character. Do you spend a lot of time on character names? Do you change them, or do you just kind of visualize the person and that name that comes in the head that usually pretty much sticks?
I think it varies. I do know that until the name is right, the story doesn't come together.
And some of these, so they went through a lot of revisions on names, and then you said, that's it.
Yeah. You know, and for most of these stories, I'm trying to think, most of them, the names came fairly soon in the drafts. The titles are another matter entirely. I do know that until I have a title, I don't understand my story until I have the title, and then things click. And so I'm trying to think, I think with most of these stories in this collection, the names came fairly quick.
Yeah. They just all, you know, I would sometimes sit there and go, is there a better name for, and I could never come up with one. So that's always a good, it's like, yeah, that really captures it. So, you know, transitioning to that next, you know, the only thing missing is the howling of the wolves. And you just mentioned, coming up with the title, and great title for that one. And I'm not familiar with that phrase. Is that a phrase, or is that something, where did you come up with that?
I think I made that one up. But I'd have to check, cause it's been a while since I've worked on that story. It sounded to me like the kind of thing that I would hear up north. And so, there's a character in a store who says that, and I was like, oh yeah, that's what he would say. And I think it took me a while to get that line. If I have this recollection of looking it up as well, and so it might have been out there in the consciousness as well. But once that line got where it was, I then had my title for the story.
Yeah, it's kind of that folksy wisdom, and the character that says it is exactly the person that you think would picture saying it. So I wanted to read a passage from that story. And I've mentioned Lynette, and just to kind of give an example to listeners about some of the density and the richness that, you know, had referred to before. Lynette had lost her driver's license years ago, and one of her Narconon friends had dropped her and the kid off at my house in the country. There I was trying to install her borrowed car seat in my pickup so could take her back home. She was like wild mint in the garden I couldn't eradicate. It kept coming, sucking the nourishment from everything I planted. Then she was handing me Wendell, installing the seat as if she were born to such things. And I think that just captures, you know, in one paragraph, tells you so much about Lynette. And, you know, the word, you know, the Narcanon, you know, it's just one word, but that creates so much images, you know, because of the L. Ron Hubbard and, you know, and that connection. And it tells you so much about that person. Again, how do you work to these details? Like, how did you connect, you know, when you had this Lynette and putting her with this L. Ron Hubbard, you know, installation?
You know, with Lynette, I think with all of these stories, but especially with that one, it wasn't until the voice was right. Once I can tap into a voice, I hear the words, which is actually can be a problem for a lot of writers too. So I the language starts to get into a rhythm, and it catches the story for me. And that can be problematic too, because sometimes I can get stuck in that and that can get monotonous. But in this case, it definitely, the story, I had written it, I had many different beginnings to that story, and I kept cutting it back and, you know, and then finally I started with that paragraph, which was deeper in the story initially, and it allowed the rest of the story to kind of spool forward.
Yeah, because, you know, in the story, she just, Lynette shows up at her brother's house with her grandson that she took from daycare, and has this idea that he needs to be baptized. And geographically, you had mentioned kind of up north. Is that Michigan? You imagine this? I know that they're driving and they end up in Michigan. So geographically, that's where this is set.
Right. It starts in Wisconsin and then they keep driving north until they reach Michigan. And that part of the country, it, you know, up north, I think Michigan, Wisconsin kind of blend together a little bit. Although don't tell that to a Michigander or a Wisconsinite. I agree.
Yeah. And so her brother's name is Harlan, and, you know, they go, obviously, go way back into getting into these kind of situations, right? Lynette was always getting her brother into these type situations, but he couldn't ever say no to her. And I love the wild mint analogy there. Are you a gardener, or where did the mint, you know, comparing the person to that?
Came from Harlan, because I am, you know, I had him originally as an ex-con, and I think I took a lot of that out. So, you know, he stole some things from the trucking company he worked for. He was a guy that went to college, though. He was in the Vietnam War, smart guy. And yet he comes from this background that, you know, has held him back, or as he believes kind of allowed himself to hold himself back. And he has inherited his ex-wife's home. She gave it to him when she died, and with it, this little patch of land. And he sells plants at the farmers markets because he can't get a job, and he doesn't really need to work that much either. And so, for him, in the earlier versions of the story, which were much longer, he was doing a lot with there were more plant references in the story. But I think there's only one that made it, and maybe a reference to a tree and some burlap that used to be in the back of the truck.
Yeah. And, you know, you get this feeling that he, like you said, he really is a good guy, but he's never been able to kind of get out of his own way, or when he would be having success. Like, he was driving across country with the one job, and he stopped at that ex-wife's house, and, you know, they had kind of a rekindling, and for once he kind of, I think, felt a little sense of belonging and safety, and so he stayed the night and ends up losing his job, you know. Mm-hmm. So even when he probably makes a good choice and has a positive experience, it has negative consequences. And so with the preacher, where they finally end up, and in that town, or what's happening with that church?
The chapel is one of these, you know, it's a small town church that it doesn't have as many parishioners anymore. And it's out in the middle of the woods, and it's primitive in a lot of ways. And there's a preacher there that has lost his faith And he, as you know, we don't know a lot about what happened, but you can tell that he's lost his family, and that he's in a moment in his life where he's questioned everything, and he's kind of also stuck. And so he refuses to do baptisms inside the church, at least for this, for Lynette and Harlan. He suspects that there's something going on here, and he's about to call the police because he sees this kid who's really worse for the wear, and these supposed parents who are way too old to be his parents, and something doesn't seem right to him, and yet he still takes money from them to baptize the child in the river.
And it seems to have when he does, there seems to be the child has kind of a Wendell has kind of a, there's kind of a moment of peace about it. I got the feeling. Is that what was intended? Or it's kind of open-ended, but I don't know if I just pulled that away, or if did you intend that for that to be kind of like that, just, I don't want to say it's an empty, it's just kind of a beat, like a moment there where there's so much kind of anxiety and pain throughout. Maybe it is, things just got quiet for just a brief moment, so you sense that it's a positive experience.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, that scene is so fraught for me. It was a really hard scene to write, but when I'm writing, I'm always trying to shift the energy. And so if things are getting too heavy, which, you know, that's the direction I go in, I'm just, you know, I'm drawn to darker, complex stories. And so, but I have to be careful that I don't stay in that same tone too long. And some readers might argue that I do, but, you know, I'm constantly trying to change the energy and not do the same thing over and over.
Yeah, because there's a buildup of they're going, they get there. Is it going to happen? Is it going to happen? And it happens. And then it's like, okay, what next? So there almost had to be that kind of moment, that beat for kind of the energy to collect and then go in a new direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I also think too, there, you know, place plays such a role in things. You know, when you take a story that's been more interior, and this story, there's a lot of outdoors in it, but when you suddenly have these characters outside and it's night and there's a river, you know, that's flowing pretty fast, and you know, and there's trouble on the horizon, it just sort of changes the energy naturally.
Yeah, and I use a lot of setting in my writing as well. It's always another character that I really believe in, that kind of sacred places and working those in. And, you know, they choose people as much as people choose them. And you really got that sense in this story. All right. So moving on to the How to Walk on Water. And again, just another great opening line. I'll show you the backside of your soul. That's what Arvel Wilkes told Nolan's mother, Sigrid, the night of the attack. Just great, draws you right in. And again, like I said, Arvel Wilkes, guy sounds like a serial killer. You know, it's like, I had to think, was that a real serial killer? And, you know, and then just like the name Sigrid and Nolan, and just right out front, okay, there's something that happened in the past, and that kind of floats through this whole story. So what do you think is the transformation in Nolan? Where is Nolan, the son, at the beginning of the story?
So at the beginning of the story, it's so funny now that we put these three stories together, we have three men that are really pretty... you know, the story begins when they're stuck. So, in this case, Nolan has moved back home. He is a grifter, and his mother's living in a little condo in Seattle, and she takes him in, and he's trying to restart his life and get back on track.
Yeah. And he very much is worried about his mother, right? He has this fear and concern for his mother. But he's not exactly in a great place himself.
No, and I think he definitely tries to transfer his issues onto her. But, you know, here's the thing is, like, with this story, which I think is the most difficult story I've ever written. It was hard. It was creepy for me to write it. Yeah. And, but the reason I wrote it is I was teaching fiction at Western Michigan, and I had quite a few students in a couple semesters of this where they would write serial killer stories where the serial killer would just be glorified and it would be, you know, funny. It was during the Dexter years. And I think in one course I strongly suggested, and I usually don't do this, that they don't write a serial killer story, which meant that I got even more because writers are born to break rules. And so then I challenged some students to try to write the serial killer story from a different point of view in which it isn't fixated on the actual murders, and try to take it from a different angle. And my students, the few that I was talking to this about, they were really complaining about that and said, well, you try to do that. It's impossible. And so I did. And that's what, this is the story that came out of it.
Yeah. There is this ominous, you know, overtone to it, but you never really get into a little bit of the, you know, of the details of what happened, but it's more on a survivor, you know. You don't really get into him and what he did. And part of Nolan, when the attack, he was actually in the house. He was just a young boy in the crib, right? So I think that's some of what drives his fascination.
Yeah, in that story, once I realized that, I tried writing it from Sigrid's point of view and it didn't work. And then once, I think I Nolan originally was a daughter and it didn't work still. And then I thought, I need more distance. And so I made, so Nolan became, this was maybe a couple drafts in, and then Nolan became a son, and all of a sudden it was focused on him, and it became way more interesting to me because, you know, there's every person that I can think of has in some way been affected by the stuff that their parents have survived, and, you know, more so in some cases than in others. And so when you start thinking about, you know, a child having to work through something that they didn't actually experience, and yet it's in the room with them all the time, that made it, the story suddenly more interesting to me. And also the fact that she gets through it and lives her life and she's okay. I wanted a story where the victim wasn't such a victim that they were incapacitated. And so that part of the story was really good, was great to write.
Yeah. And I love that Nolan just, you know, he thinks of himself as the hero and that he's got his, you know, his stuff together. And, you know, even when he's just picking up odd jobs as a day laborer and, you know, he wants to take the other guy out. Rolando, I think is his name, that he worked with him for a day, wants to take him out. You know, he's going to buy him the beer. And, you know, he's this big shot. He's got it together. And then he ends up, the car gets towed, and he starts to realize that, you know, maybe I don't have my stuff together as much as I think I do. And, you know, you mentioned that, you know, that I didn't realize the three stories that I picked all had those similar tones. So I guess that says something about me. But, you know, you had mentioned you can sometimes go in, you know, kind of that darkness, that you're drawn to those darker stories. And, you know, what do you think, where do you think that comes from?
I think, you know, who knows, but I think some of it comes from where I grew up. You know, it was I don't want to say tough background, but like my dad definitely came from a tougher background, and, you know, with more working class, small town, rural, the stories I heard were really tragic and they were super funny. And it wasn't until I was an adult and I would retell these stories that had been told over and over. And my dad was such a storyteller. He would just, you know, he would be in a diner suddenly talking to a stranger, and the next thing you know, there would be a circle of people around him. And it wasn't until I moved to the West Coast and I was telling some really well-adjusted friends one of the family stories, and they all looked at me in horror and they didn't laugh. And they were like, I'm really sorry. Did you ever get therapy for that? I was meanwhile laughing, you know, the tears are pouring out of my eyes. And I realized, you know, that for me, those stories that are so compelling, they're really tragic in a lot of ways, are dark, but there's also something uplifting and, you know, existential, something just so human about those stories. And those are the ones we retell, and we retell them for a reason, you know, to be able to, you know, get some control over them maybe, or like change the narrative going forward. And for whatever reason, those are the stories that I've been drawn to for as long as I can remember. Not that I don't like a good uplifting story too, but.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that's where, you know, the truth and, you know, you mentioned before about growth and, you know, in Buddhism, you know, in that muck, you know, is what it's referred to as, that's where the opportunity, you know, that's where the opportunity lies. So I think some of, you know, wanting to go into that darker stories is kind of getting into that muck and not worried about getting a little dirty, because, you know, what's going to come out of it, you know, is growth. Hopefully, if you work through it and you don't get lost in it. You know, those were the three that I picked out. Is there any one that you want to, that kind of maybe as a contrast or a different tone or story?
You know, that was so kind of you to take those three stories and to read them so deeply. I really appreciate that. And there are different tones in the book. You know, there's different stories. But I do think that in those three stories, there is sort of, you know, that those are the major threads that weave through the collection as a whole. There is humor in these stories as well. Not all of them, but yeah. So I think that I love the idea of getting down into the muck. I think that'd be a great title for a book, for your book. You gotta write your self-help book, Get Down Into the Muck. It could also double as a book on writing.
Yeah. And I mean, I really liked Advice for the Haunted as well. I thought that was really good. Like I said, I don't know why, but I kind of got into, somewhere along in my reading, you know, was kind of a mystical, and maybe it is some of the poetic aspects of the writing, but there was just so much. And then, you know, I really enjoyed that with in that story as well.
Oh, thank you so much, Doug. I'm looking forward to reading your work. I've heard quite a bit about it, so I'm excited to pick up your book. And what are you working on now?
I'm working on a new book. It's called Nice to See Me, and it's got a lot about narcissism, but it's set in Ohio, lakeside town, where some children, you know, disappear from a neighborhood park, and, you know, town goes in lockdown and concerned and what happened. But then all of a sudden, one of the children show back up, and the story she has to tell, you know, it's a question of, will they believe it? And so it's got a little bit of Wrinkle in Time in it. There's some magical realism, and I'm really, it's a little kind of veering from my other work, but I'm really enjoying writing. And maybe that's too why I was picking up on a lot of the kind of mystical aspects, because I'm focusing on that more, and how to do that with, you know, in the writing, without, you know, just kind of being more subtle with it, creating, you know, that atmosphere just by the words that you choose.
Oh, it sounds like the kind of story that just pulls you in. And I'm not surprised too that you're moving in that direction. I think so many of us are really questioning, like, you know, how do we write fiction right now, when there's so much that's so crazy in the world? And, you know, what can fiction do? That realism, because we're getting heavy doses of realism right now. And, you know, the mystical, it just, or maybe the unknown, I think, the mystery, it's even more compelling these days, for me anyway.
You know, so we also, you know, mentioned that you're also teaching, and, you know, I looked up one class that you're currently are teaching. And so your students, I mean, what was their response to your book? What did they think when, you know, now that when your book came out?
Well, I'm actually not teaching this semester. I took the semester off to do a book tour. I was going to do an old friend's book tour and go from city to see people I hadn't seen in a long time. So, but it turned out to be great to have this time at home to do, to, you know, to still try to launch the book. And so I'm not teaching right now, and I actually, as far as fiction writing goes, at the moment, I teach fiction just in short little workshops. But at the Art Institute, I'm teaching a literature course. I teach one every semester, and so the next one I teach is going to be on literature of Chicago. And so it's all kinds of Chicago writers that I'm bringing in. And I normally teach a ghost stories course, and I teach a course called Portrait of the Artist because it's at an art school. And so there's, you know, I bring in books that follow the lives of artists.
Yeah. And that must have been the course description that I read, the one that you're going to, you know, the how does the art of a city, you know, expand or, you know, complicate the idea of what the city, like in this case Chicago, is, and you get into different types of artists. I mean, it sounds really good. Have you taught that before?
No, that's what I will be doing for the next several weeks, is really, you know, trying to get at that, pull that course together. I'm going to teach it again a second time. So there's so much. I mean, Chicago is so rich in terms of literature, and there's so much I want to bring in for a short course. So we'll see how it goes. And then I'm looking forward to teaching it again after the pandemic, because when I originally thought of the course, what I wanted to do was take students out on field trips all over the city. You know, the different neighborhoods. There's so many great museums here. There's just so many fantastic sites to visit. So next time.
Yeah. So when you start, you're starting back in January.
Mm-hmm.
Is that so? Will it be virtual?
It will, yeah.
Okay, that'll be a new experience.
Well, I did do some virtually when we went into lockdown in March, so it was kind of halfway through my course. I got a little practice doing it, but it's definitely challenging. It's really challenging for the students. I feel bad for them to not, especially, you know, new freshmen and sophomores who haven't spent much time on their own, and they're suddenly back in their childhood bedrooms and, you know, trying to navigate all of this. And this for the Art Institute, we do have some students that are on site. And so it'll be kind of a mixed experience because they need to have access to the art studios here.
So you had said that a lot of stuff you had cut or, you know, didn't make it in this book, or a lot of different ideas. Is there anything new that you're working on, or what's next?
I have way, like you, I have a feeling you have lots of projects, and I've been the last couple of days I've been working on a short story that will hopefully go into an anthology. And then I have a novel that I've been trying to finish for about 7-8 years now, and I'm hoping to get to finish that. And then I've got a whole list of projects. I'd love to write a play. There's some adaptations I want to look at. I've got an idea for another novel I'd like to start, a much shorter and simpler one. I'm learning how to be not so complex.
So any last thoughts or comments you want to share with listeners about you or your book?
No, I just thank you so much for having me, Doug. And I really appreciate this conversation. And it's such a rarity to have someone give you so much attention and you know, to read your work so deeply. And I think that's one of the things I've been taking away from this whole experience, is just what a gift that is. And, you know, in the way that we live now, attention is just it's a hot commodity. And I'm really appreciative of it. And I'm hoping that your book flows out in the way that you want it to, and that I get to read it soon.
Yeah, well, I have to say, and you're probably getting, you know, feeling that gratitude from people, because your work is just so strong, and it really speaks, and it does draw you in. And I don't know if you really have a choice about not reading it deeply, because there's just so much that, like I said before, to chew on. It's rich, it's dense, and, you know, just really, really enjoyed it. So share, where can listeners find the book? Where can they learn more about you?
So you can visit me on my website, which is rachelswearingen.com, and you can find the book in your independent bookstore. You might have to ask them to order it for you, but that would be the best place to go. And it's also available online at bookshop.org, if Amazon too, if you must, and elsewhere.
Yeah, we love our independent booksellers, and it's always should be all our listeners' first stop for when they want a book or they want a book idea or just to really talk to some interesting people, because the other part of this podcast is I talk to booksellers, and part of my journey as an author that I didn't realize one of the benefits is just getting to know booksellers and just what an interesting group of people, so unique, but share this passion for books. And it's always so energizing. And that's really the genesis of this podcast, is to, you know, really get to know them more and celebrate what they're doing and giving back to the world and sharing in their passion of the books.
You're here. It's great work that you're doing, Doug. And I listened to your podcast with Alex the other day, and it was wonderful. I've only known him as an author, and so I didn't even know he was a bookseller, and it didn't surprise me when I was listening. You're right, they're really amazing, and it's incredible that when you can walk into your neighborhood bookstore and go and ask your bookseller what you're looking for or what you might need, what you don't even know that you need, and they'll be able to help you. And I think all of us writers are appreciating that even more, and very much wanting to protect that experience.
Well, it's time for us to head back home. Thanks to Rachel Swearingen, author of How to Walk on Water, available wherever books are sold. And thanks to all of you for taking a stroll with us and visiting the store next door. I'm Doug Cooper, author of the award-winning Outside In and The Investment Club, and the 2019 thriller Focus Lost. We're brought to you by Rare Bird Books, based in Los Angeles, a publisher of 50-plus books per year, distributed worldwide by PGW. When you're out and about and around, remember that store next door is your gateway to past, present, and future worlds.